Blog Talk Radio.
We're shy of one horse.
You brought too many.
afternoon. Show number 1,363. Welcome. It's great to sit down and get down for a couple of hours with the brethren and sister in here at Soul Tree Radio in the Raw. I'm your host, Michael Lewis, singer, DJ Honeycomb, and as always, it is good to have you in the house. Soul Tree Radio in the Raw, proudly sponsored by BASNNewsroom.com and the Assassins of the Black Athlete Sports Network. Get all the good shit. The who, what, when, where, why, and how right now at www.basnnewsroom.com. Shout out to the members of the Brother Man Network, wherever they may be, Radio Reggie in Richmond, Virginia, the Orlando Ledbetter and Sonic Cheryl Jones in Philadelphia, E. Anthon Sr. in Detroit, Mike Robeson in Oakland, California, co-hosts of the African American Athlete Show, which you hear Tuesdays 9 p.m. here on Blog Talk and elsewhere. Great listen, please lend the brothers your ears and check out the great website, theAfricanAmericanAthlete.com. Our brother Pat Freeman, the mighty Oba, may his tribe increase, will likely grace us this afternoon around 2:30 to talk about his new book, The Art of the Interview. Well done, Oba, by the way, and you know, talk about the things that make a good interview. In addition, brothers will pop in and out here and there. And as always with me, the bad man from the East Bay, Gary Norris Gray. And I want to say, first of all, I'd say happy birthday to my nephew, Waj, who's out there slinging. Thank you for keeping us safe. Love to the family and all the other good stuff. Enjoy your birthday. But, G, there's also another birthday that's in the mix here. And ironic, because if this guy didn't exist, we would have likely not met.
Yes.
And that's Roland Rogers. Mm-hmm.
He's 74. Will be 74 years old this year.
Mm-hmm. Roland is significant, obviously, because of the creation of the Black Athlete Sports Network. But yes, go ahead, please.
For over 2 decades, the Black Athlete Sports Network has served as the definitive source for information about the black athlete. Whether it be historical or analytical, BASN has always celebrated the contributions of sport's most innovative and unique being, the black athlete. In 2016, as we relaunch blackathlete.com, look for more of the same from our unique set of writers and historians. We have been and always will be the soul of sports. We are BASN.
We are BASN.
You better believe it.
Now,
and the fact that
we are
BASN covers 22 years of history.
Michael, we are headed for a not so lovely summer. Why is that? It's because another incident with guns that night in Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
The Republican Party, I can't tell you, tell people this,
mm-hmm.
They don't care. They do not care, right?
No.
Democrats, they're lazy bastards. They will not even get up for them.
Mm-hmm.
So we, the people of the United States, okay, demand, not request.
Yep.
Not curry. Demand that there is change in the gun law of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Look, I'll say this, because the thing that was not brought out in trial was brought out by a soul patroller who lived in Minnesota. And she brought everything out that made everybody understand we got a mess. People already knew there was a difference between the size of the taser and the size of the revolver. I'm talking about Dante right now.
Yep.
And add to that, that when she said what she said, and I'm going to give credit to my Soul Patrol, the Lady Scarlet, down in Texas. She did it, meaning the whole taser, taser, taser thing, in a way to show others how to get away with murder. Now, we've seen that the taser also has a bright yellow or neon, whatever the hell it is, to distinguish it from a gun.
And also, it's four and a half pounds lighter. So you can't do that difference.
Exactly. All of these factors come into play, and this way nobody can say they didn't know. They definitely knew. Actually, the statement made by my friend says that their weight is vastly different. They are worn on opposite sides.
Yes.
On her duty belt. And she had to release the safety on her Glock before she could fire.
Right.
Now, we saw all of that.
Michael, this is the thing that bothers me.
Mm-hmm.
You put your service weapon on your power side.
Right.
It'll be right on that. You put on your power side.
Mm-hmm.
So what he did was, and this is automatic, when you're in trouble, you go to your power side.
Yeah. But let's remember, she wasn't in trouble. And when I say trouble, I don't mean like her life wasn't in danger from this kid and his lady and whatever in the car, whatever. She wasn't in danger like that. If she takes out her taser and zaps his ass, it's a controlled situation. Now, I understand life and death. I understand seconds to act. But if you know damn well you're going to your strong side, you're going to pull out your gun.
Yep.
And that gun is black. That Glock 17 is black. There's no way you can mistake it for a taser.
Yep.
So, look, she's also a trainer. She has 26 years of training and all this stuff. And the part about saying taser three times, which many say they have never heard before, offers a lot of suspicion. So basically, she was letting the trainee know how killing a black person is done to protect his own culpability and negligence to keep his job, all while she had an actual gun in her hand. Now, if that police department's use of her for training others is a primary reference for qualifying another murder like that, well, that says more about the department than it says her, because they would defend her. You know, the union would defend her ass. So she put herself in a precarious situation because she couldn't extricate herself out of it based on her actions. She should be indicted for murder.
Michael, this thing goes deeper than that. This thing goes way deep.
Mm-hmm.
You have a trial of an officer right now in that same city. That officer committed murder. I'm sorry, guys, it's murder. Straight up. Female police officer, this is what bothers me. You had the name, you had the address, you had the car, you had the number of the license plate.
Right.
So you could have waited. You could have waited till later to get this guy. No.
Mm-hmm.
This power and control stuff. Power and control stuff. It's getting America in trouble, serious trouble. Because what happened was, they said, okay, we can't let this Negro go now.
Mm-hmm.
That's the power and control. Because
well, think about
all you could have done was,
yes,
get back in the car.
Think about what,
get back in the car.
Right. She could have done that, but she did not. Now, what you're saying makes too much sense, and that's probably why it wasn't done.
That's right. There you
you
go.
Remember what was done in Oklahoma to that brother who was murdered by that cop, Betty Shelby, who got off, and now she's working for another police department. Ultimately, Minnesota is under a serious microscope. Now, I doubt they'll defund the police as they're saying all that. But the hesitation to not even consider it for alternative methods, in spite of the fact that their black police commissioner, the newly hired one, I say, has seen all this pile down on Minneapolis. And you got to wonder what the Sam Hill is going on there. This is beyond ham sandwich. This is just disgusting.
Well, I'm going to tell you one thing right now. People don't know this. Minneapolis has a large Ethiopian, Somalian population. Very large. That's what's going on there. They don't want these Ethiopians, Somalians in their city.
Right. Gary, look, in all honesty, I really don't know how this trial is going to come out. With the mountain of evidence.
They will find a way to get this guy out. What?
I say that go ahead.
I'm just saying they will find a legal way to get this guy off. I'm telling you.
Well, you said it only takes one person. And you're right. Only one. You've seen the evidence. You heard them talk about it for 2 weeks. You saw how the prosecution was able to counter any kind of argument or attempt at argument. And you also saw, unless you missed it, you saw the judge tell somebody straight up, if you continue this course of action, I'm going to call a mistrial. So he peeped his whole card there, too. You wouldn't think of such a man mountain of evidence stacked. Video evidence, attitudes, and the fact that the other three cops haven't been tried yet. Everything sets the standard right here with this decision. If they don't, if they do not unanimously fry this guy, there will be some shit going on in Minneapolis. And my soul patroller up there intimated that if the case is lost, because the fear was a case was going to be moved to a different venue, if the case is lost, everything you want to hear about Minnesota Nice will be buried forever.
Michael, this trial, how many times are we going to repeat this episode? How many times are we going to do this? I don't know about you, but I get tired of this game. You know?
Everybody gets tired.
Every 3 or 4 years is a curse.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Another black man goes down, loses a father,
mm-hmm.
loses a son, loses a brother. Every year we do this.
Mm-hmm. Their idea is to help the hurt. Yeah.
See, the question becomes, how are we going to change this paradigm?
Look,
I've said this before.
I know people have brought this up, Gary, but the only way to change it, hit those motherfuckers in the wallet. You got to tap that wallet. If somebody knows, their pension will be in jeopardy because they are acting out of line with what their job entails, that shit will stop.
This woman, rather than go to trial or go to court, she resigned from the police force one day after the incident. Why?
She resigned very quickly. She resigned very quickly because the heat from this was not going to go away. So she said, I resigned. It was almost like, oopsie, I'm sorry y'all spotted me killing this motherfucker, so I got to resign for now, and we'll see what real life takes.
See you later.
Yeah. Well, it's a see you later moment for sure. But I want to flip back to where we started in talking about Roland Rogers and the fact that, you know, we would never have met. It was very likely we would have met, but no. I don't think we would have had a chance to meet because our paths would have just been different.
Yeah.
Roland, in theory, put together a great team of people and wanted to go forth with the mindset that this is what we need to do. And for the last 22 years, we've done it.
Yep.
Is there any specific thing about Roland that endeared you to him?
Okay. I'll never forget this. I wrote an article about the Washington Football Club.
Right.
Roland said, can we print this article? Oh, sure. Go ahead, rock out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Two weeks later, I get a call from Roland saying, you need to go on the air and talk about this. And I can't do that. Nobody understands what I'm saying. Said, don't worry about it. Just go on the air and talk about the Washington Football Club. If he did not insist on doing that, I would not be here right now. But he insisted on me talking about the Washington Football Club and that name.
I think one thing that made Roland work with this, picked out people like you, like Tony, helped get this message across. And he attracted real journalists and people who needed to say something and wanted to say something. And for the years he was here, BASN made their point. And because of that, I got to meet and connect with some interesting people, like the young man who's coming on now, the professor, Fred Whitted.
Young editor and historian, thank you, Fred.
Mm-hmm.
Michael, I never would have met a man in Blackhorse.
Right. Well, sometimes it's that person who creates the bind that ties us may be off somewhere else afterwards, but when they make the connection, it makes all the difference in the world. And Fred, you've been an archivist for years, and not that we didn't know, we're just moving in different circles. And through BASN, I got to connect with you. And we're talking about Roland Rogers and the fact that he created BASN, you know, the reasons why he had to create it. First of all, how are you today? And second, what do you find endearing about what we do here at BASN?
Well, good afternoon, There's a lot of things I find both interesting and necessary. My catchphrase is always, we got to tell our own story.
Yep.
It's ludicrous to sit up and wait on white folks to tell our story when the story, we already know a lot of the story that they tell about us already wrong. So why would we go back to that? We got, think about it. We have over 100 HBCUs, especially now that Morris Brown is being revived. These schools were put in place to educate us. Some people say miseducate. I say it was a combination of both. But at the end of the day, that was God's way of getting us out of where we were, because we couldn't go to Alabama. We couldn't go to Georgia. We couldn't go to Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Think about it. You got Florida and Florida State. The boundaries of the schools abut each other at a railroad track. Okay?
Yep.
Everybody's talking about the black man that is the head coach at University of North Carolina now. Well, why did it take so long? And all these other things that are happening. So these are the kind of things that we are addressing. And then we also looking at, part of what we are addressing is when we understand how good we are because we know our history, and we're not so prone to wait for, Tom Joyner used to have that little thing, ask the white man. Well, the white man is part of the problem, They're the one who put the miseducation. They put miseducation in place as opposed to putting real education in place. And if you ever read the Miseducation of the Negro, one of the things that they talk about, that Dr. Woodson talked about, is there were black people who thought it was too good to teach black history. There were blacks who thought it was too good to teach or explore black literature, and most of them had gone to black people. A lot of them had been educated at black schools where they got a solid foundation, but then when they went to graduate school at places like Columbia, as great as Columbia is, has been to blacks. There's also a sore spot there because so many of the teachers that came out of places like Columbia, Yale, Harvard, Indiana, Michigan, all those schools outside of the South that were areas of education for us, they were also miseducating us about who and what we were, valuing our knowledge base. So, because I actually met one of those people who had been one of those who said, other people ain't done nothing that nobody want to know about. And I'm thinking,
that's true.
So you never heard of George Washington Carver. You never heard of, a whole litany of places. Look, and to think that all those years we heard about this one black guy who got killed, who was trying to become an astronaut. He got killed in the process.
Right.
Even all the way forward to Ron McNair, he died in the
the shuttle crash. Mm-hmm.
So and by some people's notion, he shouldn't have even been on there because what's a black man doing going in the space? But
there
then
you
we
go.
Find out, he's what, and all of a sudden, Katherine Johnson and her crew pop up.
Right.
Well, what's the significance there? Think about the school in the South, which means when they went to school prior to 1955, when they were in college, most of those ladies went to HBCUs. Matter of fact, of the ones of note, only two that I remember went to Indiana, one went to Cleveland State.
Right.
So all the one who went to Cleveland State started out as there's much more value if we tell our story than we wait for
always,
because for those years, Miss Johnson was not recognized because she was ninth or was over 90 years old.
Right. Now, as you say that, our guest, he ain't our guest, but our family member here is in the house along with Radio Reggie.
He is
a member of the media and has been involved in things going on in the western part of New York State for a very long time. A sports fan for 27 years. Radio host. He is known as the Mighty Oba. He is our brother Patrick Freeman. Is in the house, Dr. Patrick Freeman. Oba,
Mighty,
can you hear us?
Yeah, make sure you put doctor there. Make sure you put doctor on it. Put some respect on his name.
What's happening?
You put some respect on his name.
Yes, indeed. May Oba's tribe increase. And Patrick, other than just saying what's up, we're here to discuss your book, your new book, The Art of the Interview, Book One. And this is a compilation of the best of the message radio show. Now, books are books, but the methodology sometimes differs. First of all, how long have you been compiling interviews to do this book?
Since 1994.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, since 1994. The message started September the 9th of 1994, and I've got over 400 interviews. That's why I said book one.
Oh, wow.
We'll be working on book two soon.
Mm-hmm.
And those were just eight interviews that I wanted to get into the first book. I adore all my interviews, and I feel like I was blessed to have an opportunity to talk to some of these giants and to put it in book form. Basically, you're taking their words and put it into book form so people can really sit down and hear what some of these great, great minds had to say. Chapter
Most
one
definitely.
Is Dr. Naeem Akbar. And when I talked to him and I told him I was doing the book, he loved the idea. And he said, well, Brother Freeman, do you still have that? The tape of the interview we did? I said, yeah. He said, can you send it to me? I said, yeah. And about a day later, he called me back, and he said, brother, it sounds like we're talking today.
Yeah.
I said, that's scary, Doc.
Mm-hmm.
That's scary. And, you know, his book was Breaking the Psychological Chains of Slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And he's one of the most brilliant minds that we have, and I was honored to put him in the book along with the late exalted ancestor, Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. As you know, broke down the white supremacy and its bastard child racism. Most people still don't understand that, you know. And she analyzed it and put it back to you so you understand that this is a system created by a man. There's only one race on the planet. That's the human race. But man decided to put one superior over the other, and then they created racism to justify their superiority.
That's right.
And,
no question
about
it.
The way she broke it down was just, I was in awe. I interviewed her three or four times.
I've read the ISIS papers when it first came out. And what I found so illuminating about it was she was like, okay, we know this is a weight on us. And it's all right to acknowledge that you might be afraid, but let that shit work through you so that we can handle this. You know,
right.
Be more mad than scared, essentially, is what she was saying in my mind from the gist of the book. But the fact that she said it, it put a lot of these other so-called intellectuals to shame because it was just a straight path, no-nonsense approach.
Right. Yeah, she's a great mind. And the way that she approached it, and she suffered a lot from that. They were trying to put her out of her house at the time of her transition, and she lost her job at these so-called black universities.
Mm-hmm.
And she was basically fired from Howard University. Dr. Naeem Akbar was fired from Morehouse College. Why? Because they would not conform to the control mechanism that controls these HBCUs. Look at their endowments.
There you go.
Look at their endowments.
Yeah. It's always
following
money.
That's why it was very important for them to destroy Bill Cosby, because Bill Cosby was doing something you weren't supposed to do. Right?
That's exactly right.
And I'm not going to debate his guilt or innocence. I'm talking about his philanthropy.
But you're bang on. Love him or hate him, he was writing checks to Spelman College in the millions.
Big
and
time.
You cannot defuse that. You can't water it down and say he didn't do it. He did that. It was in the bank account.
Right.
Did he get a refund?
I don't think. And if you go to Spelman College today, the first building you're going to run into is Abby Rockefeller Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And then Rockwell Hall. And you just go down the line. I'm like, man, you know who controls these places?
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to bite the hand that feeds you. That's
exactly.
Just the law of nature. But Bill Cosby.
What made you decide to put the book out now?
I just thought it was, I'm retired, so that helped. After I received the Doctorate of Humane Letters, the university, the seminary university started talking to me about, hey, man, you got to get a book out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've been pondering doing this. So I had two editors, Dr. Jesse Sharp of Washington, D.C.,
mm-hmm.
and Kyra Eubanks of Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
Yeah.
And they were my editors, and it allowed me to make all of my crazy mistakes that, you know, after a while you've written books, you get tunnel vision. Is the infamous Dr. Fred Whitted on. He knows you guys are book writers. You know what happens. On a long project, you see the thing over and over again, and you start missing stuff. So I had two good editors, and Dr. Jesse Sharp doubled as editor and publisher, and
mm-hmm.
He was the publisher of the book for me, and that helped me put it together, you know, because
mm-hmm.
don't get me wrong, I made several errors. That had to be fixed along the way to get to the point
mm-hmm.
where we are. And then he
yep.
told me, he said, don't worry. There is no perfect book. It doesn't happen.
There you go.
You know, and,
right.
Thank you.
And I had to, it was good, you know, but being retired helps.
Mm-hmm.
When you don't have to go into that angry white man environment every day. You know, and a lot
you
of you know,
kidding.
I was law enforcement, you know, I was
mm-hmm.
a university police officer, and man, since Obama got elected, it's just angry white man day, you know.
That's right.
And then when they elected Trump, you know what I'm talking about. And
yep.
you know, along the way, I just think that added the stress on you doing things. Even though I think I got a lot done, regardless,
mm-hmm.
but. Not things of this nature that require a lot of time and provocative thought. First, you got to transcribe all those interviews.
That's right.
And that's a challenge within itself. And then to put it in book form and everything that surrounds it, it became easier to do. And I thought
mm-hmm.
that I owed it to the community. You saw I dedicated it to my parents.
Yep.
And I dedicated the book to the Merriweather family, who are an extremely,
mm-hmm.
When it comes to black media in Buffalo, it
mm-hmm.
starts and begins with them, to me.
All right.
I mean, they weren't the only ones, but they've been around for close to 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
And they've allowed me to write for them for 27 years.
Before I move this on to the panel, I want to know from you, what makes a good interview? in your mind? Is the questions asked, or is it the person willing to ask or answer questions?
Well, you know, Mike, I have a – if you remember when I interviewed you about
mm-hmm.
your book, and you sent me your book, and if you remember, I never asked you a question that you didn't know about. So
yeah.
I had to read your book,
mm-hmm.
and I pulled all my questions from what you wrote.
Mm-hmm.
So you were able to get into a comfort zone. To me, it puts you in a comfort zone, whereas after we did that interview on my sports show,
yes,
there were a lot of people calling wanted a copy of your book.
Mm-hmm.
Because to me, I would never do an interview until I had your material in front of my face
mm-hmm.
and all of my questions were related to what you had put together, either through video, lecture, audio, lecture,
mm-hmm.
or written material.
Yes.
And if you notice, I did not ask a question outside of what Michael Ingram wrote.
You're right. Yep. That is so true.
I don't remember you stuttering over any question because I came directly from you.
No, I did not. That's right.
and that was always
yeah.
my motto. And
yes.
it didn't make a difference. But it also taught me, too. Because think about the people that I interviewed. For me to interview Dr. Naeem Akbar, I had to read the book. To
yep.
interview Dr. Francis Kress Welsing and ask intelligent questions about the Kress
exactly.
theory, I had to be
yep.
familiar with it.
That's right.
So it helped me grow as a person, and that's what I tried to do for 14 years.
All right. We are listening to Dr. Patrick Freeman. He is the author of The Art of the Interview, Book 1, here on Soul Tree Radio and the Raw. I want to pass the questioning on to your cuz, Brother Reggie.
Well, Reg,
who's
birthday.
Got a birthday coming up. Happy birthday. We know it's
well,
coming
happy
up.
Hey, happy birthday to Uncle Jim, the ancestor.
Yep, today's dad's birthday.
Yeah, my Uncle Jim.
yeah, he loved that.
Hey,
if there was anything he loved in life was hearing Reggie call him Uncle Jim because he didn't have any brothers and sisters. And just to hear Reggie say that, he would always comment, I love hearing it. I love when Reg calls me Uncle Jim.
Yeah,
so,
I was
yeah.
mocking my Uncle Jim.
yes, sir.
God bless. But, you know, Oba, first of all, give the history. We're talking about the book because I think it's interesting that every chapter of the person you talked about, there was a picture of the individuals, so people know who they look like. Second of all, in the closing chapter, I love it that you finally gave yourself some love as far as being the youngest, what was it, Worshipful Master and Lodge 16 up in Buffalo, New York.
Yeah, I was one
but,
of them. Not
yeah.
the youngest. One
so you
of
was one of them, huh?
Mm-hmm.
But first of all, talk about your trip to the homeland at an early age.
Okay.
How old were you when you visited Egypt?
God.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Many moons ago.
Yeah. 20. I had to be. Goodness. That was 1997.
Mm.
I was 34. Yeah.
And I
was 34 years old.
I never got when you told me that they cut the noses off of the different statues. I was like, what?
Everywhere.
Yeah.
yeah. That's just evil. Evil people.
Yeah,
they just knocked them
figure.
Off. But
yeah,
that was one of I went to ancient Egypt with Dr. Asa Hilliard, who he's not in this book, but he'll be in the upcoming books.
Mm-hmm.
That was a great trip. Eye opening, life changing, everything you think you know, you better go to the motherland. And do your studies and liberate your mind and your soul. Because that was a life-changing trip. Life-changing.
Right. But about your book, talk about not only the closing where you gave your thoughts about each individual that you talked to, but talk about also the different heartaches you had from people who looked like you that was upset with the message. They wanted your show off there in the worst way.
Oh, yeah, and eventually they succeeded. But that's what in everything, everything you do. That's part of white supremacy and racism. It's bastard child racism is to pit, culture against culture, leader against leader. That's what brought down the civil rights struggle. They kept playing people in every organization until they literally just knocked everything off focus, or they put them in prison, they trump up charges on you, or they assassinate you. You know, so it's no different. And I enjoyed doing the message, but eventually somebody convinced the radio station that the message was expendable in 2008. So
you did the same thing to your sports show too, didn't you?
Well, no, I resigned from sports, but it was time to go. Also, you know what I'm saying? Because sometimes you need to change your environment. Ask that guy Mike
That's
Ingram.
True.
I met him; he was writing at one place, and when I met him again, he was at another. It was time to go.
Yep. Yeah, that's so true.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's so true. Didn't realize that, but that's right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sometimes you got to change locations. I mean, I'm still doing radio. I'm not the head guy, you know, I'm just a contributor. But I really didn't want to be the number one guy anymore, because that's a lot of work if you're doing your work, you know.
Yeah, I believe it.
So,
with the pandemic and everything.
Yeah, I'm happy. I have no regrets. I enjoyed my time at UFO, but it was time to go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have a different relationship with 105.5. I really don't have to go there. Everything's over the clean feed, you know, but I do that from home.
Mm-hmm.
And then writing for the Criterion, I've written for the Criterion now for 27 years.
Yeah.
And I still write for them. And they, it's the oldest black newspaper here. And I'm going to, as long as I have a breath in my body, I'm going to keep doing that.
Right.
It also keeps my accreditation in the Pro Football Writers Association, too. So there's a rational reason that I'm at also.
Right.
So
one last question, Pat.
Super Bowl.
Yeah, one last question. Your thoughts about Mr. Davis, the new coach of North Carolina men's basketball team. Yeah, oh, Hubert. Yeah, you know, Mr. you know, I got a white wife. And
I
don't
am
you
mystified.
Forget it.
I'm mystified, bro. You know what I'm saying? I had my questions on them hiring Hubert. Not because of Hubert not being qualified, but Hubert, out of all the New York Knicks, and you know I'm a Knicks fan.
New York.
How about them Knicks, baby? Five in a row, they rolling.
Yeah. What I want you to examine
Knicks
is
rolling.
That out of all those Knicks players, remember, they're playing in the greatest city on the planet.
Yes.
Oh, Lord.
They're playing in the media capital of the world, right?
Yep.
Well, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, out of those Knicks teams of the 90s, all those guys did well with endorsements.
Yeah.
The name one endorsement Hubert Davis got.
Nah, where the white women at?
Well, that's what I'm saying. He never benefited. How do you not benefit from playing in New York City? John Starks did well. Charles Oakley did well. Patrick Ewing did well. I can go down the list.
Yep.
What did Hubert Davis get?
I do know
Mike. I do know something that Hubert did do. He was
did try out for the movie Get Out, but he didn't get the role. But
Okay. There you go.
Come on, Tommy.
And see, that was my question when they hired him. I said, dude, are you ready to be the front guy? Because, hey, you can say what you want to about Roy Williams and Nick Saban. When I saw the video of Roy Williams and Nick Saban doing line dancing in the hood, I said, no matter. This is why these guys get all the best recruits. And they wasn't line dancing at some white gathering. This was
no,
in the hood. And they were better than some of the people they were line dancing with. I said, no wonder this joke is fine and everybody.
They
know what to do. Nick Saban said, shoot, man, please.
He's at home. He ain't worried. He said, where the fried chicken at? In the collard greens.
Dude was line dancing. Him and Roy Williams, those guys went out and got recruits. I don't know if Hubert Davis fits that profile.
No.
You see what I'm saying?
That's a good point.
University of North Carolina is what, top five?
Get the profile of the white women.
Yep.
Hey, here get the white recruits in there. Get a bunch of white boys on the football
but
team.
Why would you even bring that up? I mean, but think about it, Reg. Would you, as a white person, would you want someone that brought something up like that up in the matter?
Hell no.
No.
Hell no.
I mean, dude, this is, that's your wife, okay? It told me you're not.
Yep.
Told me you got some issues.
Some.
It told me that later down the line, there might be a problem with your being hired as the head coach of this institution. Similar to Matt Doherty, remember? Matt Doherty was one of the failed coaches.
You discussed that on Wednesday show, Oba.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Two or three years, he's gone. David's gone. 2 to 3 years, he is gone.
Right.
Gentlemen, if I can reset for a hot second, I want everybody to know that you're listening to Soul Tree Radio on the Raw, our guest, one of our people, Dr. Patrick Freeman. He's written the book, The Art of the Interview, Book One, knowing that there's going to be a 2 and a 3 coming down the pike. This is kind of synchronic because we are talking about this on Roland Rogers' birthday. Roland born in Buffalo, New York. And I want to talk to the editor-in-chief emeritus, Tony McClain, to say a couple of words on Roland before we carry on with the interview with Dr. Freeman. So, T-Mac.
Well, the one thing I can blame Roland for, I wouldn't know any of you guys if it wasn't for Roland Rogers. I could use that as a crutch, or I could.
wouldn't brag about that too. I wouldn't brag about
that. That's what I'm saying. I'm going back and forth with that. but seriously though, Roland was a visionary in the sense of what Gary, what Reggie has done, and I will always be indebted to him in that, because if we were all brought together, because the thing is, even in this climate, things really haven't changed. We still have to tell our own stories. We still have to mobilize as media folks, as black men in general. And, Roland put that seed out there. And if not for the relationship that I had with him, I would not have met, Mike and Gary and Pat and Reg. And the thing about it is, it's like another family in a sense. And especially now when you realize just how certain things have changed, but fundamentally things are still the same. We still are dealing with the same sort of prejudices as these folks, as black men, and what have you. And Roland was one of many folks who got that ball rolling and got that ball start. And we, especially now, I think we owe a debt to him in that sense of being one of the, you know, being one of the pioneers. And, you know, there was the folks that were before him as well, but he took their cue, and we are still taking his cue. And Pat's book, I think, is reflective of that because,
yes,
you know, everything in there is us. You know, we and the,
yeah,
it is the ultimate in being able to express what we do, express what we think, unashamedly. You know, there's a, you know, there was the documentary a few years ago that talked about Jack Johnson, and it was called I had it on the tip of my tongue and I forgot it. Unashamedly Black.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the one thing that even now we still have to be. Unfortunately, there's still people that are a little uncomfortable with that. Sad thing is, a lot of people who look like us who are comfortable with it. We expect it from the other folks, but when you get it from your own, glad that, you know, we were able to keep and are still keeping his dream alive on all the different things we do, whether it's this show, whether it's Gary's show, whether it's what Oba's doing, whether it's what Reds is doing, and everybody else. And to me, that's the one thing that keeps us all going. Because like Pat said, there comes a time when you do sort of just have to move on and what have you, but you still keep the same basic message of putting the work together, of putting that information out there. And I think it behooves all of us that the fact that we're all still here, because, you know, we've lost a lot of folks along the way, including, you know, Roland was one. You lost Roland along the way, but the most important thing is we've kept his dream alive, and most importantly, I think we've taken his dream to a different level.
No question. Yeah. I think that's because...
And real quick, T, I got to say, because of Roland, you guys did radio from a mic to T-Mac, then Gary. And T, a lot of times you host our radio show, you know, for the whole month of August. So I thank you for that, you, Mike, and Gary.
Listen, the pride money helps too, but, you know.
And we got a tongue lash from the professor. Hey, Mike, we got a tongue lash from the professor showing us how great Winston was and trashing Virginia State, but I still love him.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, I'm thankful for the collective spirit that engendered all this. You know, Roland did lead to all of us somehow connecting with each other, even Patrick and me in the Super Bowl. And because of that, that's why I call this Lucy thing, this Lucy connected thing, the Brother Man Network, because Patrick's in Western New York, and I'm thinking, all right, what's Oba up to? Fred's down in Fayetteville, North Kakalaki, and I'm wondering what the professor's up to. Gary's out west in Cali. Tony's in New England. You know, we're here for a reason, and I've always believed in my heart that when something manifests itself in front of your face, you have to roll with it. There's just something that's connective to it. And this has become something that was connective, no matter how loose or how tight it was. I knew that we were all doing work. You know, I knew 3 years ago Patrick told us that the NFL was going to do certain things, and they did it. You know,
did they not?
Exactly. That's they not. And, you know, that the professor would write a book. And when I first asked him about it for a free copy, he said, let me pray on it. In other words, Mike, give me $30, please. So I did it. And we've been connected ever since. You know, Tony, we talked about hockey trivia, and that's how we were able to connect, and I got in through him. And, of course, G, you know, who now we roll together. The strength of him being able to do what he's doing and not worry about anything else but getting it done, I found amazing. And Reggie,
hey,
doing the thing at the radio station. Yes.
If you remember, what was it, 5 or 6 years ago?
Yes.
Well, who was the guest we were talking to about the underground money? He's,
was it Bernie Parrish?
Yes, Bernie
Parrish. It was Bernie. That's
Parrish. And the NFL had been trying to get their tentacles in the underground money for years.
Yes, they have.
On yesterday, they announced a three-way partnership.
Yep, sure did.
With the online gambling people who they've been quietly financing all along.
Sure
did. The NFL and the government. Because they're going to tax all this under. They're going to try to put all the parlays out of business.
Wow.
And if they catch you doing parlays, the fines are going to be astronomical. The same thing they did with the numbers.
That's exactly
same thing.
Right.
Yep.
And now they don't legalize weed in New York?
Somebody
can help these brothers find a gig. They've been selling weed for years because you ain't going to be selling weed no more, bro.
Yeah.
You better read the fine
print. They won't get robbed in no car games no more in New York.
Hold on, y'all. That doesn't sit well with the guy who got arrested in the 1970s for a fucking dime bag of weed when Rockefeller put those draconian drug laws up there.
Mike, they're getting their sponge in all of those.
Yeah.
They're sponging all weed convictions in New York State. All of them. And they're telling you from now on, you have to become a legalized cannabis dispenser.
Look at that.
You have to have a license.
Mm-hmm.
A license costs a lot of money.
Yep.
And if you get caught selling weed, we're sponging everything. You will have a new charge. That's a RICO violation.
Mike,
you know RICO violations what took down Al Capone.
Yeah.
The feds are getting 13% of all weed dispensing sales.
NFL
has partnered with the government so they can tax your winnings on your gambling.
That's right.
The last piece of this, which is so important on how these beautiful owners have gotten their way. They bought off the NFLPA.
They did.
Because Demaryius Smith was challenged.
Who?
Demaryius Smith was challenged in the last election period, but he arranged with the executive board to change the rules, and he was automatically reelected without the 1,300 NFL players voting on it, right?
Oh, Lord.
So he cuts the deal that this is how sick this is, brother. Sick. Now, remember, all NFL players used to get 17 paychecks, right?
That's right.
If you make the team, you get a paycheck every week of the season for your whole contract for that year. This new deal has been stretched from 17 weeks to 36 weeks. Did you know that?
And they can tax them more, too, right? Yeah, they can tax them more.
You're right, you can tax them more.
Tax you more. I can make money off of your contract while I'm paying you.
I can invest
money and get money back right away in 36 weeks compared to 17?
Shit, that's and like now when you're going to the pay. Bank machine.
The same contract that you were paid the lower guys who voted for this stupid contract, they're going to be getting that same amount of money that they were getting over 17 weeks is now going to be over 36 weeks.
That's right.
And now you got to play an extra game, which only benefits the owners.
That's right.
How does it benefit you?
Yeah, so basically you're paying an extra game and you're taking a, for lack of a better word, you're taking a pay cut.
Right.
You're taking a pay
and
cut
you're
for playing
shortening
the
your,
game. That's
your career,
exactly
the
right.
Only average what NFL player lasts, what, 3.5 years?
Barely
so now I'm
going to
give you an extra game and
that's
the playoffs
right.
If you make the playoffs? Come on, man.
If you make the playoffs.
And you know what, guys? That three and a half years thing that we're talking about, that's going back about 15, 20 years. I think that
That's
average
right.
is probably smaller now. I think it,
yeah,
I don't
it,
think,
it probably,
I think it's
it probably
than,
is.
It's almost less than 2 years now. I, you know,
we had Lifford Hobley, if you remember, former Miami Dolphin, as one of several ex-old school players who tried to tell us about the ins and outs of all of this stuff financially. And I find out in casual interviews, which is why what Pat wrote is so important, because the interview really does reveal more than just GB won the last second coach or was a rough game coach. No, when players are relaxed enough in their environment, they will tell you what's really going on. It's hard
right.
to imagine the NFL is a sweatshop, but that's exactly what it is. And
that's all it is.
That arrangement being switched from 17 to 36 weeks is like you going to the bank, taking out $20, knowing that the bank is going to hit you with a $2.50 charge for taking out your money.
Money.
And so
right.
you can just do the math and imagine that amassed on the size of a contract and the amount of money that we intimate here. So this is
yeah.
this is really eye-opening stuff. And, of course, the mouse and other members of this mishmash of alphabet bullshit, they're not going to tell you about all of this.
No.
That's why it's important that we all are out here. And to just wrap the Roland Rogers thing up, he made us feel like we were not alone. We knew something was coming off somewhere else, and there was a moral obligation with many of us, if not all of us, to make sure that that information was passed on. And that's exactly what has happened here.
Yeah. It's
yes,
a look. It's, you know, we live in an information society, but so much of the information that we're given and that's dispensed is bullshit. And it takes
yeah.
doing what we do separate, you know, literally to separate the shit from the shinola. And there's
gotcha.
So much, you know, there's so much. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned Damare Smith, because if you go
Who?
To our Facebook, yeah, I know. Well, Damare Smith, Ralph Ellison, same, you know, same difference.
Okay.
But it's funny because one of the few times I actually was flipping around the dial and actually stopped at the mouse, the soul of sports. Check out who I saw speaking in public for the first time in like forever. I'm not going to tell you. Just I'm going to implore you to go to it, but I literally took a picture of it on my TV. I had to take a picture of it on my TV to be like, okay, now I can't say that I didn't see him, and now I can't say that he doesn't exist because he's there. But to say all that, but to put that all back again, it is literally and figuratively crazy how this thing has and is going to play out for the NFL. And I would implore anybody that actually wants to watch the draft for information, stay the hell away from your TV for the next 2 weeks up until the 29th, because you're going to just get all sorts of lies, damned lies.
You ain't shitting.
Up down your throat.
Right.
Mm-mm-mm. You know, Pat, in addition to doing a book like this, you know, the other side of the question has to be asked. What makes a bad interview, and what interviews did you hear by so-called professionals that really stunk the high heaven, made you wonder why were you actually there in the first place?
Say that again, Mike.
I said, what makes a bad interview? Fact that people ask bad questions, or the fact that they don't care about their subject matter. You know, what are the things that you think make for a bad interview?
Not being prepared, and for us, we can't afford not to be prepared. So
thank you.
You know, we're not supposed to be doing this anyway, so we have to be prepared.
That's right. We don't do mediocre.
I've seen some interviews whereas the interviewee and the interviewer were not even on the same page.
Yeah.
And what gets an interviewee excited about the person asking the questions is when they've done their research.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I said, I don't know Mike. All right, they know Mike on radio, and Mike writes articles for all these big magazines. But we want
Soul Tree and the Raw Mic. That's the one we want. So I have to dig into that book and get you comfortable. And once you got going, shoot, man, them phone lines lit up at the end of that show. Where can I get that book? You know, and that's what you want to do. You want to get the interviewee comfortable in their comfort zone. So basically you're merging two personalities into the document. I'm asking you about a document that you wrote and questions that you're comfortable with. And you should be able to just go into the zone over that.
Yep.
And that was always the goal, you know. And if anything, I would want people to say, well, he was always prepared and he always got the best out of the people he was interviewing. And I've seen some bad interviews, you know, every day. I see bad interviews. Stephen A. Smith does some bad interviews. Bad.
Oh, God, yes.
He just interjects
Eternal Son.
Personality.
That was
that.
That epitomized bad. Oh, yes. No doubt.
You see that too much where you have a person of notoriety on and you haven't prepared yourself well enough to dig into their what they're trying to convey. Because when a person is writing, that comes from the soul when you put it in book form.
Right.
And you're digging into information. Like you did the book on some of the great ball players that came out of HBCUs, you and Dr. Fred Wittig, the assistant dean of the University of Mars. I have to say that. and when you go into that type of writing, you begin to see that you begin to formulate a story, you know? And that's to me, that makes the interview. You know, do your research. If I was to interview Reg, I would dig into the information about him and what he did. What was it like when you enlisted into the Marine Corps? You know, I mean, everybody doesn't know that. Is Reg there? Was that Reg or was that Gary?
That was Gary.
Gary
rolling in on the Sixers. He's getting restless.
But see, if you don't do your research on who you're interviewing, I think it shows. You know what I'm saying? Like everybody always praised, what was his name, Larry King. Larry King sat there behind a microphone and just basically.
Man, he's the worst interview ever. Yeah. God, he was fine.
I didn't find him to be a great interview.
Hello, New York. New York, you're on the air. Hello.
I've heard, and I think the significance, one of the great interviewers, I think, was Gil Nobles.
Yes.
Listerfeldt Middleton.
Like it is. He's the loving show.
Was a great, great interviewer. And there has to be a purpose behind that, too. You know, you're trying to bring thought-provoking information to your community, and that's always been the goal, you know. Even with sports, we're not supposed to talk about, oh, it was just a beautiful game, blah, blah. No, I want to know more about that. Why isn't there more black coaches? You know what I'm saying? I mean, that's what we're supposed to do. You know, we're supposed to enter into the subject matter that they don't want to talk about.
Exactly.
Many of them are talking about the big money grab that the government and the NFL did a deal with yesterday. That was one of the biggest money grabs in this country.
Yeah, nothing about it.
We need to have Bernie Parrish back on. The amount of money he was talking about,
owners
wanted a piece of that ever. The biggest investors in online gambling was Jerry Jones and Kraft from the New England Patriots.
Are you surprised? Are you surprised?
That's right. The biggest investors. They've been trying to do this. They are already gearing stadiums up that you can place a bet 15 minutes before the whistle is blown.
Now think about that. That's it. You know, hold
they
on.
Don't,
think
and
about
they ain't talking
just...
about stopping for no national anthem either.
No. think about what Pat just said. Hold on, guys. Think about what Pat just said. You're in the stadium. You're watching the game. You've got a monitor next to you where you can order your food and all this other old bullshit if you're in one of the boxes. But you can see situational things come up. The XFL peeped everybody's coat to this. They did not hide the fact that the teams must score X number of points to make the over. I mean, we saw that throughout the broadcast. As a matter of fact, I found that quite illuminating. You know, the NFL, for years, who told you that to stick a thumb up your ass when it came to that because we abhor gambling, you know, they're lying out of both sides of their ass.
Please.
At least the XFL was straight up to the point and showed you what the hell was going on. And now with this cash grab, forget it. The bloom is off the rose, filter taken, all
Mike,
that stuff.
You didn't say
it
right, Mike. The cash cow.
Move. All that shit. Them motherfuckers out the pasture. All that
I mean,
Mike,
it's huge.
Mike Elsie wants to come out of retirement and come back into the whole
deal
right now.
There you go. That's right. There's a 2% chance that she will as well, but having said that.
what's the over and under
and
her coming back, Mike?
It's been
over
years of preparation with this, Mike. You know that.
Yes.
All
yes.
of a sudden, in covering NFL teams, there was more and more emphasis on time-stamped injury reports. You noticed
that's
that
right.
over the last
yep.
20 years?
Exactly.
If you didn't report
mm-hmm.
something timely, that club was fine. That's all
that's
preparing
right.
for us to
mm-hmm.
take over
the
game.
Gambling.
You
that's
had to show
exactly right.
form of
the
credibility
gambling.
With that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This
that's
has
right.
been a long time coming.
Hey, Pat,
and
how
the 17 games, everything. Yeah.
How much do
yeah.
you think it's going to hurt Vegas? How much would Vegas
I don't
be
think,
impacting
well,
them?
Well, Vegas has
Vegas
been preparing
hurt
for
this
anyway.
Listen, Vegas, Reggie. If I can answer that, Vegas isn't going to get hurt by this because all of it translates into action. And it's always about the action
yeah.
in Vegas, mm-hmm. in New Jersey, anywhere where there's betting. People don't care because the ones that are bitten by the gambling bug, they're going to keep
yeah.
showing
right.
that cash out. All they want to know
what
is
what about overseas money?
And Mike,
about overseas money?
Well, no, but see, here's the thing, though, Reg. Whether it's overseas money, whether it's domestic money, guess who they use as the gauge for the mile rhythm? Vegas.
Football.
Vegas has been, Vegas has,
no, Vegas sets the curve.
Vegas sets the
algorithm.
Vegas is basically, what's the fucking thing in Star Wars? They are basically the Death Star.
The Death Star.
Music
Vegas optional. Will not be affected
yeah,
at
yeah,
all.
Really. Yeah. Music
anything, percentages
Mike.
Of these transactions will go to Vegas. and think yeah. about it. The only place for gambling that went under was centered around guess who?
Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Ha, you got it.
Mr. New Jersey.
The
Donald Trump.
Yeah.
How in the hell you go broke with a casino?
Who made money and pulled him out?
You should have named Mr. Brett Favre. That's Mr.
Even,
Brett Favre,
yeah.
man.
The guy's terrible. But you watch how they come down on the parlays, though. That's what you need to watch for.
That's the guy.
Parlays are now going to be charged with RICO laws when the head was turned for years.
That's right.
Parlays.
And RICO's federal, which means they get everything.
Yes, sir. If you get charged with running a criminal enterprise, remember that guy,
mm-hmm.
Donald Sly Green, I interviewed?
That's right. That's
yeah.
exactly
they
right.
They said he was
mm-hmm.
one of the most notorious criminals ever. But he
that
ain't
was,
never
was,
got
was,
charged
Trump
with
Trump
anything in the
yeah,
community.
That's
he got
exactly
charged
right.
with RICO
right.
law.
What's
yeah, and they tried to imply that about Tank Black as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sly Green got 4 life terms and 135 years for RICO violations.
What did you say? You ain't never coming back.
Yeah.
He had to die. The only way he could come back is to die 4 times and then wait 135 years for somebody to say that I please.
But see,
come on, man.
This is
what I said.
This
all right,
the
nigga,
aspect,
you know where you go. Get on back in there.
This is the aspect of journalism among us that is missing from everywhere else because we know sometimes we got to laugh Keith from crying, but we also don't deviate from the fact that facts kill bullshit. And that is one thing that has been consistent through everyone on this thread, no matter what we've done collectively or individually, the facts always bear out. That's why
Excuse me, Mike. I got a news break. 7-14, Grambling nothing in the first quarter.
Thank you, brother. 7-14, Grambling. Are they playing a Grambling?
They're playing the Treeport, and the Southern quarterback got knocked out the game.
It's a rough year for Grambling, man.
Yeah, no shit. All right, so 14-0 Southern. And to finish off the point about Pat, the book he wrote has become even more illuminating because we not only have our collective places where we can share information, but there's one place above all that no one can touch where only the brothers, the interplanetary brothers and sisters can congregate. And that happens to be... sense a disturbance in the force. They are messing with motherfuckers' money. And because of that, we should speak on that. But we really haven't had people defend the situation revolving black male and female athletes, which is one another thing we can credit Roland Rogers with. It wasn't just angry Negroes shouting stuff. It was being able to present objective and factual information that would say, what the hell are you saying? You know, Roland was indirectly responsible for the articles regarding Kentucky and the hiring of Coach Calipari, where the article, The Devil and His Bride Together, spawned so much hate mail from Kentucky, we actually printed the letters to stop their nonsense so they'd realize how stupid they sounded. You know, we've had Tony and Gary and Pat and Reggie with his radio show, Professor with his archive knowledge, put all of that in front of everybody and understand. You know, it's no, the brothers ain't sleeping here. And with the contributions of people like Rhonda Harper and Sheryl Jones and Celeste Wald and others, Bobby Booker, the sisters ain't sleeping either. And we have to have that because we know the mainstream media won't tell us the truth. And that is why it is even more important that we thank Roland, not just for his vision and putting all this together, for being able to keep us all connected. So even if we go our own ways, our focus is still the same. Tell the truth. Defend and fight against the bullshit and make sure everybody hears not just that story, but as the man used to say, the rest of the story. That's what I'm grateful for as I sit here today. This is why we are recognizing Oba. And Oba, please tell everybody where they can buy your book.
Well, if you want a signed copy, you can reach out to me at 716-468-3190. But if you want to just order it, it's available on Amazon and different bookstores around the country. So you can get it.
Does anyone on the thread have any further questions for Patrick?
Well, I have not a question, but just an acknowledgement. It's a great read. It really is because it's history, it's instruction, and all of that. And see, that's the essence of what we all try to do. That whole infotainment thing that KRS talked about years ago. That's the thing that this book really hit, and I'm glad we ended. As a matter of fact, if you want a preview, we have our book review of it on at BASNnewsroom.com as well. If you want to get a little taste of it before you go out and purchase it, but yeah, it's we're all in this together, and that's the thing that I really loved about that was because it hit all different aspects of African diaspora, the and all of that. And that's why, you know, get a chance, get an opportunity, you should pick up this book, because it'll, you know, you won't be able to put it down once you pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I want to thank Anthony McQueen for writing that tremendous review of the book. I appreciate you for doing that. Much respect to all of you and all the work that you continue to do.
Yeah.
Happy birthday, Uncle Jim. Happy birthday, Uncle Jim.
Oh, yeah.
Take care, guys. I'm going to have to get out of here. But, yeah, but keep doing what you're doing. All right, we'll be in touch.
All right.
Yes,
take care.
All right, man.
Okay.
Thanks,
oh, bye.
I got to get ready to fly out of here, too.
I was going to say, y'all leaving us? Give us a preview of the show, G.
We're going to talk about the beginning of the show, about Minneapolis, Minnesota, and what we as African Americans need to do. Michael, Mighty Oba, and Reggie.
Yes, sir.
It is time to boycott the state of Minnesota. The airlines.
Mm-hmm.
The America does not respond until pocketbook issues occur.
Tell the truth.
Yep.
That's right.
Now
that's right.
We need a pocketbook issue to occur.
As Dr. King said, stretch out the pain. Let everybody have a taste of the pain.
That's right.
Right.
No question about it.
Thank you, brother. Thank you, Mike Hillbaugh, for the interviews.
Yes, indeed.
Keep it going.
We will see you at the top of the hour. Gary's preparing for the Cove. You know, Reggie, not only was it
the
cool
professor
interview.
Gone? Hey, Mike, Professor gone?
Professor's still here. The professor's still here. And I wanted to ask you guys, you know, we've all ventured out in media in some form or fashion, whether it's through book or radio or what have you and whatnot. I ask you both, what do you enjoy most about what you do? Reggie, I know you did the radio station there for a long time. What did you love about what you did?
As Professor said, bringing outsiders of the state of Virginia to tell the historical aspect. Because you'd be surprised how many people broke down the show when we had Professor Witt on talking about Black Magic. And when he gave his historical spin from John B. McClendon to the House, Big House Gangs, and then brought it home with the White Shadow, white folks was calling to the show said, I didn't know that. and so again, we had black folks that still to this day believe that Dean Smith invented the Four Corners. What do you think, Professor?
It's Saturday night. I don't want to have to go to church early in the morning. But one of the things, Reggie, we hadn't had a chance to address it, but about a week or so ago, somebody did correction. I discovered this article written about Virginia Union, specifically about the White Shadow. And, you know, I was ready to hit the ceiling. I said, wait a minute, you know, I hope this is one of these young people who ain't been exposed to nothing or nobody.
Thank you.
Because he stated that White Shadow was the first white coach at an HBCU. And as I had explained to somebody at the CIAA one year, I said, now, if he didn't come aboard until 79-80 and Coach Techhouse was at Lincoln in 1946-48, how white shadow is
Thank
he? I've discussed this with Coach. So, you know, my saying that don't, you know, he'll go, yeah, you're right. But, you know, you got these people creating these narratives out there, and you know, and I hope none of you all are Deion Sanders friends, but when I heard him say that he was going to create the greatest recruiting class ever at Jackson State, I immediately go back to the early 1960s when they had people like Harold Jackson and they had 13 guys sign. professional contracts, and two or three of them didn't even, matter of fact, there were several guys who signed contracts from a number of the HBCUs in the SWAC at the time. These guys were not only not all conference, some of these guys barely played. And if you saw Robert Brazil last week, he talked about the guy who played behind him and how good he was, and he still couldn't get on the field. You know, and my other first question was this. Okay, so you're going to have you got the all-time great recruiting class. So you're going to have at least three. No, you got to have four Hall of Famers. You got to have three Hall of Famers just to be equal. And then you got to have four to be better.
Mm-hmm.
Even what I see of them playing now, and I know he played with old somebody else's hand right now, and I know about them, but you know, and when I see my homeboy, he stayed 3 miles from where I live, Mr. Cornell Maynard, take him to task, and for those of us, and you know what I'm saying about this already, who've known Cornell for the last ever how many years?
27 years.
You ain't seen nothing yet with him, you know. And the kind of stuff that's being put out there as fact. To know that we have a mechanism now to go back and okay, hold up, wait a minute. This is who really did that. This is what really happened. And those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And see, when you talk about getting into these interviews and stuff, you know, I did an interview with Earl Lloyd when the CIAA was in Raleigh. And I will never forget introducing him to some of my friends, some guys that were there at the tournament for my church. They said, well, who is this guy? I said, that's the first black man to play in the NBA. But I didn't tell him until he took a picture with him, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, he's so down there. I said, well, yeah. Because that's how people were back then. These old guys around here, they're just great people who happen to play basketball or football. And I say, you know, when we get out there and start telling their stories, you know, I've had to correct some people on Big House, you know, and I've, you know, but we have so much richness out there. I mean, that's why, you know, I appreciate more today than ever that I got invited to this meeting 30-some years ago with Coach Mack and some of the old heads. I mean, there were some issues there, and there's still some issues now. But at the same time, to be able to start the process of putting this stuff all in one place. So every time, because see, right now, they try to tell me, well, you know, we shouldn't do that because it's going to hurt the new museum in D.C. I said, no, it won't. Go through there now. And when you went through there, did you see Coach Chasm, who? What did you see? I saw Eddie Robinson. I saw Big House. Really? So you saw the best, but you didn't see the rest. And being able to tell the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey used to say, it's part of what this is all about.
Mm-hmm.
It is what it's all about. And I think it's rather apropos that on Roland Rogers' birthday, we reconnect with many of the reasons that we all are connected in our own individual and collective missions to get stuff out and get it to people so that at least you can say, we got it right here, whether y'all want it or not, that's on you. And that is what the show has always been about. When we started this in 2012, that is what it continues to be about. And as we carry on, we, Brother Man Network, continues on with everyone doing the thing that they love and doing the thing that's needed to make sure, as Fred says, we tell our own stories.
Yes, sir.
Mike, something else to look at, too. Remember, most of us have never met each other. Now,
that's right.
I'm waiting for
the official. The official gathering when we are all finally in the same room. Hey, Mike, I got something to touch right there. I was right there when a certain athletic director was pacing back and forth and had his battle fatigues on in the stands.
That's right. I know I'm be talking to Fred with a plate of food in my hand and I'm be eyeing the pineapple upside down cake as soon as I'm finished.
I mean, pineapple upside down cake, that's a great draw for me. I mean, I get three of them a year, but you know, I can always take more.
Yeah.
But you know, at the championship, possibly at the tournament.
Winston against your man, Lisbon City, when they played, when Tiller was coaching them.
And then T-Mac used to be at the CIAA. I've seen him two or three times. We worked in Winston. But then there's so many of the others. And see, as long as Gary stays out in California because it shakes so much, I don't think I ever go back out there.
I hear that.
He still has people not too far from me, so when Gary comes to this side of the map, we'll roll down together.
Because, see, Obi's going to have to leave Buffalo because that promised God, my brother, and four other people. I ain't going back up there. It's just too cold.
Well, it will be interesting to see what happens.
When I come down and get barbecue in North Carolina, I come to Fayetteville and holler at you. I'm going to make a road trip and give me some barbecue from Garden.
Come on down. Hey, there's barbecue down here, too.
All right, let me know where the good one is so I can make a run down there.
You can pull it or you can cut it, either way you want to go.
Hey, I take both.
Now we talking.
Yes, Fayetteville, here I come.
The love that all of this is being done from a satellite perspective doesn't change the fact that it's still getting the truth out and it's getting the stories told so that the right story comes out and nobody's making no mistake. And I love that aspect of it. And in that regard, I love the fact that all our colleagues are doing the same thing and for the same reason. So that's even more important to me. So, gentlemen, before I sign off, Professor, you have some final wisdom for us for this afternoon?
Well, I've expended most of mine, but I'll just leave with this. You know, we have a story to tell, and we have to tell our own story. But you know, we have to go out and not only tell our story. We got to, no matter how much you know, you still got to learn some more, some new things. We got to do some rewrites. We got to do some editing. And some of it just flat out correcting. I mean, you know. We still got people out here shooting us like we're crazy, like we're animals.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And, you know, I still don't have a good – I watched parts of the trial up in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. And this is gonna be a pace setter.
Yeah.
Personally,
you're right.
I thought the prosecution was weak, and then I thought the defense was pathetic.
Mm-hmm.
But a pathetic defense like that can, because see, all it takes is one white and one.
That's right, one person.
All it takes is for doing what they call seeding. You know, you can have that one white person and possibly a black person up there who, no matter what, well, I don't see it wasn't all his fault.
Yep.
And see, remember, the presumption with the police is they were right,
mm-hmm.
no matter how wrong they may have been. You know, we had a sheriff here who nailed three of his officers, it basically was an honest mistake, but they messed up by trying to cover it up, and they covered it up, and they covered it up so bad that he had to step in and say, okay, you go to their house, 7 o'clock in the morning, have them in my office in handcuffs by 7:30. And you guys, when I did it, and see, when it comes to sports, you know, it's just a game. But think about it.
Yeah.
These games are worth billions and billions of dollars. And we need to get in on our share of it. We need to make our share of it, but then we need to share our share of it. And same thing with information. Too.
No joke. That's what I'm talking about. If you want more stuff, books, T-shirts, www.blackheritagereview.com. Wisdom is always wisdom is always on sale. Reading's fundamental. And thank you, Professor, for coming on in the afternoon and giving us a little bit of love. Reggie, give us a little bit of truth to take us home.
Well, it's down to 7:21, grounding nothing, and I got a feeling this Bayou class is going to get ugly real quick. That's another two-hour show. I, like Professor said, I'm nervous about this trial in Minnesota, but it's amazing how the white female assassin got a lower charge, manslaughter, when the former black cop shot a European. He gets the book thrown at him. He's still sitting up in jail.
Well, he is.
All I'm saying again, that when people tell me, how come we heard nothing about those people that attacked the Capitol? Because you got the white supremacist council of citizens on both sides of the fence. It ain't just Republicans who are sitting back saying, look out for them white folks. You got a bunch of Democrats, too. So both of that side, one's a donkey, one is an elephant. But both of them look at us in the same direction. They just better hide it. All I got to say is that, hey, if we don't get out and take care of our own, and now, it ain't going to never happen. Just food for thought.
I share. I share with both of you that whole apprehension about what's going to finally turn over when this thing comes to a decision. Doesn't matter how stacked the deck is or how effective the prosecution has been. One person may be laying in wait, ready to just explode all of this with the contention that they will not make a decision. Even if it's guilty or innocent, they won't make a decision at all. And that will cause a mistrial. And that will cause, well, we haven't come there yet. But don't think it's not sitting in the brain of everybody else. And for somebody who couldn't sleep for 3 days after seeing that man get murdered like that, live and in living color, as Patrick likes to say, you would like to be optimistic, but it's kind of hard to do that. I want to thank Pat Freeman, the mighty Ova, for coming on and sharing his book with us. It is a good book. I recommend everybody The Art of the Interviewer, Book One. This is the best of the doctor's performances on the Message Radio Show in Buffalo, New York. Patrick Freeman, Dr. Patrick Freeman, the author. You can find it on Amazon, The Art of the Interview, Book One. We're going to take this over to Gary Norris Gray and the Gray Leopard Cove in a few. Everybody else, please. As spring is trying to sprung, I think. Y'all just be careful out there. Once you get from A to B and back to A, okay. Please wash your hands. Please wash your ass. Please wear a mask. Please. And no matter what, always watch your back.
Hey, when are you going to throw a little light on this play?
This is not quite a standard operation. I mean, run as tight as you are.
You mean is that each of us knows only his own job?
Put it in any words you like.
Well, the company must be running a couple other teams. Are we number one?
Two teams only. And there's a good chance that you'll see action. Maybe before Thanksgiving.
How soon will we find out what the options are?
The probabilities for success are almost 100%.
And like the Bay of Pigs.
Now, look, you're a high-risk man. You're on contract. Your men are all experienced in black operations. You take your chances and you get paid for it, and damn well.
Okay, Jim.
I'll tell you this much. I've never seen a better cover plan in all my life. Every man jack of you will be out of the country within 36 hours. New passports, new identities, plus $25,000 each just for spending money.
I like that. Tell me more.
You'll stay out of the country for 2 years. You'll receive $25,000 a year via Switzerland for the next 5 years.
All of us?
I said every man Jack involved in the operation. And 5 years from now, on January 2nd, 1968, provided no one has broken security, each man will find $100,000 in his own personally numbered Swiss bank account.
Jesus. You just told me who we're gonna hit.
This nation was founded by men of many nations and backgrounds.
Okay.
It was founded on the principle that all men are created equal, and that the rights of every man are diminished when the rights of one man are threatened. My fellow Americans, this is a problem which faces us all, in every city of the North as well as the South. Today, there are Negroes unemployed 2 or 3 times as many compared to whites. Inadequate education, moving into the large cities, unable to find work, denied the equal rights. We cannot say to 10% of the population that you can't have that right. Your children can't have the chance to develop whatever talents they have. That the only way that they're going to get their rights is to go in the street and demonstrate. I think we owe them and we owe ourselves a better country than that.
The computer threw out 14 possible goats, or sponsors as we like to call them. A young man named Lee Harvey Oswald seems the best. Born New Orleans, 1939. Father dead. Mother remarried and divorced. Boy was placed in an orphanage for a while, then shunted about with his mother till he was 17. You can start now, Tim. He has a remarkably muddled political record that could be steered strongly to the left.
On October 24, 1956, 7 days after his 17th birthday, subject enlisted in the United States Marine Corps.
Attended aviation fundamental school at Naval Air Station in Jacksonville, Florida. Studying basic radar theory, map reading, and air traffic control procedures. Began studying Russian language and taking pro-communist attitudes. Fellow Marines called him Oswaldovich and Rusky.
In the Marine Corps? Not a chance. Preparing a cover for him.
Naval intelligence?
Either that or CIA.
Go ahead, Tim.
Arrived in Yokosuka, Japan, aboard the Bexar, for assignment at Atsugi, 20 miles west of Tokyo.
Isn't that where we monitored the U-2s over China?
And a lot of other stuff.
Court-martialed on June 27 for pouring a drink over a non-commissioned officer's head and use of insulting language. Confined 28 days at hard labor.
Only 28 days? Not only giving him a cover, they're fixing him a phony.
On August 17, 1959, he requested a dependency discharge on the ground that his mother required his support. Discharge was granted September 11.
Well, that was easy.
Easier than you think. Watch this.
To get the discharge, he needed a doctor's affidavit. Otolaryngologist Marvin Danvers gave one, saying he started treating Oswald's mother on September 5. Even though his letter is dated September 3.
Well, I'll be goddamned.
On the same day, September 4, Oswald applied for and received a passport. Quote, in order to attend Albert Schweitzer College. Unquote. Passport granted. Good for European travel, including USSR. Arrived in Moscow October 16. Ordered to leave USSR by 8 p.m. October 21.
The Ruskies weren't buying.
Slashed his wrist same day. Taken to Botkinskaya Hospital. Released a week later. Visited U.S. Embassy on October 31. Stated his determination to revoke American citizenship and turn classified data over to the Russians. Can find no record that Embassy tried to dissuade him from handing over classified material.
How much did he actually have?
Location of all bases on the West Coast, radio frequencies for all squadrons, all tactical call signs, strength of squadrons, number and type of aircraft in each, names of commanding officers, and the authentic code for entering and exiting the ADIZ radio and radar ranges.
Jeez.
On January 4, 1960, Oswald receives permission to remain in the USSR for 1 year.
They're beginning to buy.
On January 5, he is given 5,000 rubles and assigned to work at the Belorussian Radio and Television Factory in Minsk.
They've bought.
In 1961, he writes a series of letters to the embassy concerning possible return to the United States.
When was power shot down in that U-2?
May 1, 1960. He was there all right. but I'm not sure there was any connection. They've been spotting our U-2s for a long time. Thanks, Jim. I'll take it from here.
Right, Mr. Farrington.
On March 17th, he met a young lady, a graduate pharmacist. 6 weeks later, they were married. As a result of Oswald's letters, the State Department informed Embassy that for security reasons, Oswald should be given a passport. There was a long wrangle with the Russians about exit visas for his wife, but everything on our side was as smooth as silk. The embassy issued a passport. They lent him $435 in traveling expenses, and he passed through immigration June 13th, 1962, en route to Fort Worth.
Did anyone meet them at immigration?
A representative of the Concerned Traveler Society named Ralph P. Waterford to help them through customs, or so he said.
That name familiar.
There's a Ralph P. Waterford known in Taiwan as the Secretary General for the World Campaign Against Communism, Inc.
Now, who would have sent him?
God knows. You get into that area, there's so many little double and triple headers that you can't count them all. Tim? All the intelligence agencies have files on him. He was interviewed twice last year by the FBI that we know of. And there's a report out that the State Attorney General and the Dallas District Attorney I've got him labeled as FBI informant number S172.
He could be. Defecting, coming back, running into no trouble at all. He could be anything. CIA, Office of Naval Intelligence, anything. Lowest possible echelon, of course. A few dollars here, a few there. Possibly a little doubling.
Listen. On January 27th of this year, he bought a mail-order Smith & Wesson 38 under a phony name. And in March, he bought a mail-order 6.5-millimeter Mannlicher Carcano rifle. In May, he was distributing Fair Play for Cuba literature in Dallas.
Can we rely on a character like this?
We're not relying on him. We're using him. I've got someone placed very close to him.
Get a little air.
Go ahead, I want to check the stock market, of course.
Real problem is this, James. In 2 decades, there will be 7 billion human beings on this planet. Most of them brown, yellow, or black. All of them hungry. All of them determined to love. They'll swarm out of their breeding grounds into Europe and North America. Hence Vietnam. An all-out effort there will give us control of South Asia for decades to come. And with proper planning, we can reduce the population to 550 million by the end of the century. I know. I've seen the data.
We sound rather like gods reading the Doomsday Book, don't we?
Well, someone has to do it. Not only will the nations affected be better off, but the techniques developed there can be used to reduce our own excess population. Blacks, Puerto Ricans, Mexican Americans, poverty-prone whites, and so forth.
All right, over the weekend I watched When They See Us, Ava DuVernay's four-part series on Netflix. It was both the most beautiful and sad thing I've ever seen. It is the story of five young boys, 14 to 16 years old, who were accused of rape and assault of a white jogger based on little to no evidence at all. There was no physical evidence that connected those boys to the scene. There was no eyewitness evidence that connected them to the scene. They happened to be, what all black and brown parents fear, the wrong place at the wrong time. And their lives were turned upside down. Complicit was a legal system and powerful people that decided that these boys should be the example. And all of those people who were involved, from the district attorney to the prosecutor to even a businessman in New York, have all gone on, even despite these boys' trials and travails, have gone on to great success. Donald Trump became president. The district attorney, the prosecutor, became a best-selling author. Somebody else became a teacher at Columbia. There is nothing that you could accuse black people of that people will not believe. Nothing.
even absent evidence, not one shred of physical evidence placed those boys in the scene, a scene that bloody and that brutal with no evidence, nothing saying that they were there. Later on, the man who came forward, whose evidence was DNA was everywhere, he came forward, and they still couldn't say that those boys hadn't done it. I was reading CNN, and they talked that they had an exhaustive list of all of the men. Did an exhaustive study, and it talked about how black people are more likely to be falsely accused and adjudicated than any other race. And that is because when they see us, they see monsters. I asked Jay, who works on our show, to put together a list. He had 5 minutes to do it. He was able to come up with 92 names. Now, I can't read them all because we have commercials to run. But some of the ones that pop out are Ed Johnson, 1906, rape. Thomas and Meeks Griffin, 1913, murder. The Scottsboro Boys in 1931. Ed Brown, 1934, murder. Arthur Ellington, 1934, murder. Henry Shields, 1934, murder. George Stinney, 1944, murder. Lena Baker, 1945, murder. Reuben Carter, 1966, murder. Dewey Bozella, 1977, murder. Clarence Brantley, 1980, murder. Grover Thompson, 1981, stabbing. Troy Davis, 2011, murder. And these happens in all regions across the country. Now, these are people who somebody put at a scene and put to jail based on little or no evidence, because all you have to do is say a black person did something and people will be inclined to do it. The only thing they don't believe is that we went to school and that we work hard and that we're honest and that we love our families. You can't believe that. But any horrible thing you accuse black people of, you can get away with it and they'll do it. Those boys lost their lives because they became what that system decided they should be, monsters, and they weren't. They were children. You send a 16-year-old boy to Riker, to Attica in a maximum security prison. You ruined their life. And you know what you did? You gave them $41 million. Do you know that Erin Andrews, a white woman, somebody saw her through a peephole, and she got $50 million? So breaking five black lives doesn't mean anything. Seeing a naked white woman, everything. And every one of those people who prosecute the prosecutor, Donald Trump and the district attorney, all those people all profited from it. They sold books. They became president. They became teachers at Columbia. I don't think it's enough just to ask that we boycott that woman's books. I think she should be indicted. I think she should go to jail. I think she should suffer the same thing that they suffered. You saw those children. You didn't see children. You saw monsters, and you made them that. And you contorted them to do it. And you did it in spite of all the evidence saying no. Here's the thing I don't understand. Science says we did do it. Science says we didn't. You can say whatever you want about us, and people will believe it. Right now, Donald Trump is the president of the United States of America because he said he wasn't born here, and people believed it absent evidence. They believe the worst about us. I've said this before, and I mean it to be true. The most dangerous place for us to live is in white people's imagination. The movie is called When They See Us. I suggest that you all see it. And when they do see us, what a lovely day it'll be. Because they will finally get to see that we're no more, no less human, no less loving, no less fearful, no less flawed than anybody else. It'll be a great day in America when they do finally see us. All right, that's a little note from the GED section.
You know, we played the previous audio several times over the course of our time here since we've been on in 2012. The thing that scares me most is the truth that reverberates from it. I've said it for years. The world's getting darker. It's going to get darker and darker still. And instead of sharing whatever may come up of whatever changes manifest from that, they would destroy everything first. That's why this decision scares me. Even if they vote to convict and they try him and say he's guilty unanimously, you know, somewhere else some shit's going to spill off and there will be some more dastardly revelations manifesting around this decision and the ones to come. Ultimately, I don't pretend to have answers. What I will say is if somebody knows in a capitalist country that something that they do, the cost of their actions will cost them money, they will think twice. And right now, thinking is about as close to the truth as we can get. So tap that wallet. Spank that pension. If it means you lose money behind all of that, maybe you'll think twice. We'll see you at the Grey Leopard Cove later on in the hour. For all of us at the tree, go safe, stay safe, and be safe.